Dearly beloved, we gathered here today to get through this thing called Big Mouth, the pop culture talk show for people with too many records, books, films, and TV shows cluttering up their minds. I'm Andrew Harrison, and on the show this week we have Purple Rain, a lavish new 3CD edition of Prince's career-defining album from 1984. It's the first of what will inevitably be a downpour of reissues following Prince's death in April 2016, and it contains an additional 26 tracks, some never heard before. What's in there? How do we feel about it? And is there such a thing as too much of a good thing? Also, we'll be looking at the new Netflix comedy drama Glow, Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. Exec produced by Genji Cohen, creator of smash hit Caged Heat series Orange is the New Black, Glow retells the founding of an all-women wrestling show for US Saturday morning TV back in the 1980s. Is it worth watching? Is there a hit underneath the fluorescent spandex, the big hair, the thunder thighs grapple action, and the synth rock? And is former Mad Men actor Alison Brie a little too cheesy for the lead role? To round things off, we've got the new album by Newsreel sampling motoric duo Public Service Broadcasting. Every Valley is a poignant look at the rise and fall of Welsh mining communities. As is their modus operandi, it's almost an audio documentary, but for the first time they've got singing on it too, from James Dean Bradfield, amongst others. Have they found a rich seam of inspiration, or is it the uneconomic pits? As usual, our guests have brought some tunes in to foist upon us, so let's meet them. She's one of Britain's most influential beauty journalists. She writes for The Guardian, Elle, Grazia, Red, and countless other publications, as well as ThePool.com. She's also a rock and pop person, having started her career on Loaded in the 90s, and she managed to maintain standards of presentation and maquillage at Glastonbury last weekend, while the rest of us looked like Stig of the Dump. It's Sally Hughes. Hello, Sally. How
Hello.
Are you?
Hello. Thanks
Welcome
for
to
having
Big
me.
Mouth. So tell us about working at Loaded in the early days.
For years, every time I told people that I worked at Loaded, they sort of assumed that I got my arse grabbed day in, day out. And yeah. But actually, that wasn't the case at all. They were all really, really nice to me. They were appallingly behaved, it has to be said. That is not folklore. They were disgraceful.
Yes.
But I was quite disgraceful myself, but because I had some semblance of togetherness with my job and I was the only girl, so people remembered me, I kind of did all right out of it.
Yeah.
But they were good blokes. It was a very different magazine in those days, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, it was pre-soft porn.
Yeah, I mean, it tends to be sort of tarred with the long, slow decline and the embarrassing sort of like bad Starbird covers that they did for a long time afterwards. But in the early days, it was... One of the things that seemed to drive it was blokes being a bit guilty about their behaviour rather than just flaunting their horribleness.
Yeah, and I still think like we had some of the most iconic covers of that era, really. Kathy Burke on the cover, yeah. Smoking a Fag with Rollers in Her Hair, brilliant cover. We had we were the first mag, really, to have, I suppose you could say, plain, ordinary-looking men on the cover. So yeah. We would have Sean Ryder, we'd have Ian Brown, we'd have all sorts of people on the cover, Gary Oldman and so on, people who would never appear on those kind of glossy GQ Esquire jobbies in those days. So it was quite influential, really.
Yeah, and before that you were a celebrity makeup person, notably working with George Michael. Tell us about George.
I was. So I only wanted to be a journalist, but I was too young to get work experience, so I became a makeup artist's assistant, and we worked lots with the Pet Shop Boys and George Michael. Can you remember Dina Carroll from the 80s?
Yeah.
Dina Carroll and Belinda Carlisle and Delamitri, all the greats.
All the greats, yeah. So who was nice and who was horrible?
Do you know, in the makeup days, I can't really think of anybody horrible I ever worked with. Since I've become a journalist, I've worked with loads of dreadful people. I've interviewed some absolute horrors over the years. But actually, in makeup days, they were pretty good. Everyone was kind of happy in the early 90s, though. Everyone had money and were taking lots of drugs.
Yeah, it would be much better if we could just go on a time machine back to there. Speaking of going on time machines to happy places, you seem to have an absolute spiritual experience at Glastonbury.
I just had the most amazing time, and I'm now on a massive come down. Not even a chemical one, just an emotional one. I'm just so sad not to be there. I would like to be spirited back there.
Yes, well, we'll talk about Glastonbury in a little bit more detail later. But we're going to meet our other guest. Returning to Big Mouth, he's the most powerful music business writer in Britain. He can make or break your startup with a single tweet. Well, that's okay, because you can easily bribe him with a crate of Tato crisps. He's the most environmentally unfriendly thing to come out of Ballymena since the Boris bus. It's Eamon Ford. Hello, Eamon. Welcome back to Big Mouth.
Hello. Thank you for having me back. Good reference to the Boris bus. It was indeed made in Ballymena.
It was made in Ballymena. Yeah. And there's a little plaque on the back of this. This is in London, for listeners outside of London. All over the place. We've got listeners in Japan who probably like look at buses on the internet, I would have thought. But you see a plaque, don't you, say made in Ballymena?
Yes.
Do you curse your hometown as you're roasting to death on the Boris bus?
I curse my hometown at all times. Yes.
Now you're not a Glastonbury fan. I'm going to be talking about that a little bit later. But you've just been off to disgusting music business nose in trough event Meadem in Cannes, haven't you?
I was, yes.
So tell us about Meadem. What goes on there? Do people just wander around in Cannes, battering their expense accounts?
No, I hadn't been for about 7 years, and It was the second time they did it in the summer. They used to do it late January, early February, and it would either be quite sunny or chucking it down. But I was in a live blogging capacity, so I sat in a conference hall from 10 o'clock in the morning until about 9 o'clock at night, bashing out about 6,000 words of copy a day for 3 days. So I didn't really see much. Nope. But the days of kind of yacht parties and massive expensive kinds of all gone. I'd gone to some of the garish hotels on the Crozet, which used to be packed one in, one out. I had to show your badge to get in. And I went to, I can't remember which one it was, the Carlton and the Majestic, one of those terrible places. And there was like three people at the bar. It was just numbers way, way down. But I think they just kind of weeded out a lot of the idiots, because you used to just get these terrible, terrible chancers like trying to sell one single to Ministry of Sound. Because I used to work for AM, a trade body for indie labels, and we had a stand. And because Ministry of Sound were a member, just all of these people were coming just hawking the most terrible music. And there was guys who were just sitting with Discman. This is pre-iPod as well. Just listening to terrible promo CDs all day. And I just felt really, really sorry for them. They were just looking for that one big hit single.
With us, as usual, it's our VP of Quality Assurance, Deliverables and Customer Journey, our podcast producer, the Sir Dennis Eatonhog of podcast, Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
How's your week?
Tap into America.
How's it? Did you have a pleasant weekend not going to Glastonbury?
I did, actually. Yeah, it was really good. Friday night was the, I'm not a Glastonbury, I'm going to avoid it, and then turning it on and going, I'm really glad I'm avoiding it. And then Saturday, I kind of got into it because we watched, my kids are really into Stormzy and Dizzy Rascal and stuff, so we watched all of that on catch-up, which was brilliant. And watching the pleasure of watching a nine-year-old boy watching Dizzy Rascal and me telling him, now whatever you do, you can't repeat any of the words that you hear. And then, you know, Dizzy Rascal basically breaking the F barrier after about 30 seconds of coming on stage. It was brilliant.
And also the pleasure of not being the dad who has to take the nine-year-old boy to the field. Just park him in front of the red button and go, there he is.
Yeah, I really doff my cap, but also wonder the kind of experience people have when they take really small kids to Glastonbury, because traditionally I've either been working there, which means that at the end of the day, you go off and have it. Or I was a student, I was going there and having it kind of 24 hours a day. And so you see kind of kids, you know, the friend of the pod, Robin Turner, took his kids and had a bug in. It was great. It wasn't wet, because that would have been Dante's seventh level of hell. But I just don't understand how people
Isn't
do that.
Isn't it just like a pub? Like, these are not places for children. These are for grown-ups to get
well, there's
really
the children's field.
But also,
if you take your kids and if they're really small and they've got to go to bed kind of like 9 or 10 o'clock, that's fine, you take them to bed. But then you'd surely sit in your tent hating your children because you can't go out.
I guess you take it in turns with your co-parent, don't you? Somebody
but then one of you...
I agree, my kids are livid.
Hating your children and resenting your partner, isn't
it? Yeah, my kids are livid that I didn't take them, absolutely livid.
And I mean, I think when they get to kind of 16 or 17 or whatever, then, you know, when you can kind of release them into the field, then that's fine. But before then...
I think it's okay to take babies because they're used to lying in their own filth. It's kind of what they do all day long. Okay, so we've got two Englishmen, an Irishman and a Welsh woman, so we're well on our way to a really bad pub joke. Let's get cracking. Prince was musically prolific to the point of incontinence. He could not stop writing and recording, and the legendary vault at Paisley Park is reputed to contain literally thousands of hours of releasable material. As his original purple period recedes into the past, he seems more and not less incomprehensible. How could one guy write, play and produce everything to such a standard and be such an absolute individual, standing completely alone in the world of pop? The double deluxe edition of Purple Rain is now available, also with a triple CD and live DVD if you want to really binge out. Is this stuff for fans only, or is there something here for the general listener? And could we ever see a character like Prince again? We're going to talk about it after this track, which is nearly on the final version of Purple Rain but was replaced at the last minute. With a non-more Prince title, this is Electric Intercourse. You don't get a song called Electric Intercourse with Susan Boyle, do you? That was Prince. Sally Hughes, were you a Prince fan?
I was a huge Prince fan, and actually Purple Rain, I think, was the first album my brother ever bought me. So it wasn't the first album I ever bought, like a Virgin was, but Purple Rain was bought for me by my brother. And I listened to it practically on a loop for years. I still love it. I even love the film, which I know everybody hates, but it's a film I grew up with and meant a huge amount to me. And so I kind of felt with this, well, I mean, it's a perfect album. Why gild the lily? It's a perfect album in its entirety. Every track from start to finish takes you somewhere. And so it didn't need the extra. But as you rightly point out, it's split into different discs. Yeah. So you still have the complete album. You have it cleaned up a lot. And actually, it does sound really wonderful. The cleanup of the original album does sound really, really fantastic. And then there's another disc of extra bits and pieces. There is nothing new, I have to say. There's nothing on the extra bit that I hadn't heard before.
So are you a bootlegs nosing around downloading Find the Rare Stuff person?
Yeah, but then I kind of like having them all in the same place. So I think I had heard everything on the extras, but they're all kind of, you know, bits of MP3 lying around, bits of YouTube that I'd sort of seen over the years. But to have it all gathered in one place is quite nice, I think.
Yeah, because a couple of other Prince super nuts have been saying how amazed they are that this particular track or that particular track is finally available on, you know, because after Prince basically committed internet, you know, yeah. Eric Kerry disappeared and also attempted to remove not just his own from legitimate outlets but all other music, so there'll be no Prince on the internet. This underground developed, didn't it, of swapping, you know, swapping MP3s and WAVs and stuff, so that it seems like this is an attempt to kind of bring that up into the light.
Yeah, I think so, and Prince agreed to all this before he died as well, which I think is worth saying. I think lots of people have started to feel a bit icky about it, as though it's a bit of a Harper Lee job where you kind of botch together something when someone's gone. But actually, Prince had agreed to this. He'd gone back to Warner Brothers and agreed to do these reissues, and Purple Rain was always going to be the first one. It just never saw the light of day while he was alive. So I'm really excited about what might come next and what I won't have heard. I'm dead excited about what they'll do with Sign of the Times, for example. That's got to be a corker.
Yeah, because I mean that's an enormous album anyway. Isn't it? I mean, there is.
I mean, it's a double anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to get an octuple thing.
Yeah.
So although you'd heard a lot of this stuff before, were the particular things on the extra stuff that stood out to you? It's like, oh, I like this. This is particularly handy.
Like there were a few radio edits that I don't own that I've heard, but I was really, really pleased to have. There's a song called "Can I Swear?" There's a song called "We Can Fuck," which has been renamed. I think it became "We Can Funk" later on or something.
Old chestnut.
Yeah, but that has been around forever in various guises. There are lots of different versions of it, so it was nice to have what I think is the best version on the album. But really, I like the sort of "Let's Go Crazy" 7-inch single edit. I don't own it on 7-inch vinyl, so that was nice to have. Erotic City, I love Erotic City. Lots of good stuff.
Yeah, there's a fantastic, gigantic thing called Dance Electric, which is about 11 minutes long.
It's super long, yeah.
Insane Prince workout. And then it turns out that he'd just given this song to somebody else and you do something with it. And this would be like the centrepiece of anybody else's, you know, statement for that year. Eamon, you're a Prince fan. You running around in your purple pants in Ballymena.
I wasn't at the time. It was someone who I was kind of aware of through the singles, and then kind of it got into properly a little bit later on. So, yeah, I like Prince a lot. But I'm not sure kind of what this adds to, quote-unquote, the narrative of Purple Rain. It's kind of interesting to hear all of the stuff. But I think having listened to all of those outtakes and kind of whatever we could call them, works in progress or nearly finished pieces, he picked the best songs for the album because the kind of the sequencing on Purple Rain is incredible.
That's what I thought. I really like Prince. I'm not a kind of, you know, I don't know all of the outtakes and stuff, but I really like the way that you kind of listen to the first album, to the album as it came out, and it's got some, you know, it's obviously got the massive hits on it. Then when you listen to the second album, it's completely obvious he was holding back and he was being kind of quite constrained by putting this stuff into a movie, because there, you know, as Andrew said, there's kind of like the Dance Electric thing. There's a completely nuts, I don't know how it's never become a Christmas hit, the Another Lonely Christmas, which I don't think I'd heard before, but it starts off as kind of some totally lascivious thing, then ends up with him kind of saying it's obviously somebody who's died, and then he's kind of getting blind drunk on daiquiris at some point, a banana daiquiri. It's just like it goes on and on and on, and it's just completely
mad for the
nuts.
Well, this
that's
really
one thing I didn't pick. I picked up from this. I didn't know before. Yeah,
I'm not sure. I agree that the extra sounds unfinished, because what really surprised me is how finished it sounded. It, like, Prince didn't seem to be able to not do things to Prince standard. You know, there's no sort of off notes or, you know, bad bits of production. But you're right. I mean, it's absolutely as saturated in filth, isn't it? I mean, the titles are hilarious. You mentioned "We Can Fuck." There's "Love and Sex," "Velvet Kitty Cat." cat head.
What's
head.
That about?
I have no idea. And my favourite, wonderful ass, with the chorus, you've got a wonderful, 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 wonderful ass.
That was about me.
What's the
that
subtext
was, that
there?
That was Louis. He gave that one to Louis Armstrong as a sequel to Wonderful World, but he decided not to do it.
There's also a hilarious bit in the middle of the aforementioned Weekend Fuck, where he actually starts to whoever the lucky lady is at the moment. He's going, "Oh, baby, this is amazing. This is incredible. No, no, really, it's really amazing and incredible." That's faint praise, Prince. What's going on here? It is really about the core of the original album, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
You know,
people... Well, it's one of those albums that doesn't have, let's say, a yellow, what we could call yellow submarine syndrome, which is most great albums have an absolute stinker somewhere on them. Mm-hmm. So, Within You, Without You, or Taxman, or something like that. There's always one song that pulls the album.
What's wrong with Taxman?
What's wrong with Taxman?
What's wrong with
rubbish? Got a great.
I love Taxman.
Paul Weller built a large part of the Jam's career on Taxman.
Well, there you go.
Get out.
You need it. But most classic albums always have a stinker on it. And this
Octopus's Garden.
Yeah. So,
Ringo.
But this didn't. But it kind of goes into that idea. And this was one of the reasons why he had his huge contractual dispute with Warner, which was that he wanted to. He was in what Neil Tennant called his imperial period. Yeah. And he was just like, he was spitting music out, and it was all of an incredible standard. And obviously doing it all his own, which obviously Bowie had a hot streak in the 70s doing that. Prince had that in the 80s into the mid 90s. But it struck me, thinking about it, that this is the big thing that the music industry is grappling with at the minute in the age of kind of mass streaming, which is the idea of the album is kind of... that used to be the currency the industry was built on, and it was the way contracts were measured and so forth. But now, artists are, it's basically you're only as good as your latest single. So I think Prince, in a way, would kind of thrive in this environment of just banging new songs out every couple of months to just keep that momentum going, rather than here's 10 tracks, I'm going to disappear for 3 years, here's another 10 tracks. So I think the technology maybe has finally caught up with his way of producing music.
You could really see, I mean, the astounding story of the Purple Rain itself, the track about how it's substantially recorded live, and it's Wendy Melvin's first gig, and she's 19 years old, and they record this astonishing thing. This the other thing with Purple Rain, of course, is his first with The Revolution, isn't it? Performing as a band. Right. Yeah. Previously, Prince had sounded really sparse because it was all himself, and then he's with this kind of Sly Stone meets James Brown meets Sylvester meets Little Richard review that he's built around himself with all the soul call and responses going on. So they record this track live, take it to the studio, a couple of overdubs, shorten the solo, and there's your timeless classic.
Yeah.
And the sort of wellspring of ludicrous creativity, you think that would really suit now. You know, if you can imagine somebody at Glastonbury at the weekend had done that, decided it was great, just go, we're getting it out, bang it out.
There's a great YouTube video of that entire performance as well, but it probably disappeared very quickly because he was not a fan of YouTube.
Well, I think I saw it popped up after he'd gone and therefore wasn't able to say no. And you're watching this, you know, the sound quality is not great, but you're watching it and you're realising that the hit version you know so well is substantially what was played there and then. It's mental.
Yeah.
So we haven't talked much, we've mentioned Prince and being filthy, but the kind of, the sort of, the androgynous side, the strange, unsettling sexuality, the Little Richard side, the I'm not a woman, I'm not a man, I'm something that you'll never understand. That was way ahead of the game. And yet you sort of imagine that if a record like this came out now, it would be seen as somewhat problematic, you know, because it's so focused on sex, and it would be immediately dissected and hot-taked to death, don't you think?
I'm sure it would be, but it's interesting that you say that, because as a woman, I think that Prince is just about the only male artist who consistently gets sex brilliantly right from a female perspective, in that I never feel remotely offended by anything Prince sings about on a sexual note. because, yes, he is absolutely filthy, but also the women in his songs are absolutely filthy. Yeah. Everyone's filthy. Everyone's having a good consensual time.
Pervert.
He's an equal opportunity objectifier and pervert. And actually, I really respond to that. I think that that's much healthier than the sort of submissive, objectified woman and the man basically, you know, ruling his hose.
Yeah.
And Prince was never like that.
So, I mean, the TLDR on this is we quite like this one, didn't we?
Yeah.
We quite liked it.
Loved it. I mean, you can't, it's a perfect album. And I do think it is worth saying that despite the fact the first disc is just the album, it is really nicely cleaned up, didn't you think? I just thought it sounded really great.
Okay, Prince, we like it. Let's do some more music. Every week, we get our guests to bring in a tune of the moment, something that they love or are amazed by or just want to inflict upon the Big Mouth listener. It can be old, it can be new, as long as it's interesting. Sally Hughes, what have you got for us?
I chose Lord the Louvre, And it's quite an un-me thing to choose, I have to say. Mm-hmm. But I thought I had to choose something new. I'm not great with new, I have to say. But I saw Lord at Glastonbury and I thought she was absolutely brilliant. And I thought, I am seeing a superstar. There's something very... there's stardust around her for sure. I thought she was amazing. And this, I heard, so I listened to this album on the way to Glastonbury and on the way back. There are loads of good tracks on it, particularly the ballads. But this is my favourite just because I think the lyrics are so brilliant.
Okay, well, here it is, here's Lord and the Louvre.
Well, summer slipped us underneath her tongue. Our days and nights are perfumed with obsession. Half of my wardrobe is on your bedroom floor.
That was The Louvre by Lord, as chosen by Sally Hughes. Let's have some telly now. GLOW, which stands for Glorious Ladies of Wrestling, is Netflix's latest competitor in the crowded ring that is box set binge TV. Explicitly launched by creators Liz Flyhave and Carly Mensch as a female-centred drama comedy, it connects the kitchen corner of 80s high-concept wrestling entertainment to the aftermath of the 1970s women's movement. Alison Brie, Pete's much put-upon wife from Mad Men, plays a struggling actress who ends up in the wrestling business and reinvents herself as Zoya the Destroyer. Will GLOW make you want to throw your hat in the ring or tap out? Now, Sally Hughes, without wanting to get all spoilers on your take, I get the impression you didn't like GLOW very much.
Sylvester is, as is often the case, by far the best thing about the proceedings. I think I hated it.
Why did you hate it? What did you... Tell me what you hated about it.
On paper, I thought I would really enjoy it. I thought, you know, camp fest, half an hour long. I like half an hour things.
Yeah, no more 2 hour Netflix dramas, please.
No, I like a 30 minute thing. And I've really enjoyed other Netflix 30 minute things, like I really enjoyed Love, for example. Oh, God, where to begin? It is so unfunny. I didn't laugh once. Mm. The acting is unbelievably poor. Kate Nash somehow fails to do a British accent, which I find really
strange,
remarkable.
Yeah.
So it's like the director told her Australian would sound more authentic. It's really, really terrible.
Kate Nash is playing one of the wrestlers. The setup is essentially is, it's a We're Getting the Team Together movie in which a struggling actress goes to load of terrible failed auditions and then goes to, as she reaches her lowest ebb, she goes to the audition that isn't what she expects and she's brought into this troupe of lady wrestlers.
Exactly that. And I think the premise is actually quite nice. It looked like I might enjoy it. It looked like it might be fun. There are no jokes in it, as far as I can see. The acting's terrible. The characters are ridiculous and sort of broad. The director of the wrestling troupe is this sort of ludicrous, boozy, cokey, haggard old perv.
Yeah.
And that's basically it. That's all he is. I should have prefaced this by saying I really hated Orange is the New Black.
Okay.
And so she's got form for me in that she seems to create women I absolutely loathe.
Okay.
I hated the main character in Orange is the New Black, who I gather is not in it much anymore, so I should probably return to it. But the central couple in Orange is the New Black, I think her name is Piper, and the fiancé, the guy from American Pie, Jason Biggs. I hated them both, and I wanted her to get the death sentence.
Okay, right, well, that's certainly flying against the side there. Amy, what did you think? Right.
I thought the fact that they were selling it as a comedy drama was the wrong way to do it, because you say it's not. There were little moments of comedy, but I think I find it funny in the same way that I find Catastrophe funny, i.e. not really, and it was probably more of a drama rather than a comedy. I thought, and maybe this was, I don't know if this was kind of like a postmodern Double Matter reference back to the 80s, but it seemed that all the characters fitted into a very 80s archetype. There was the fat one, there was the goth one, there was
the blaxploitation star.
Yeah, there was the wife whose husband's cheated on her. There's the girl who just wants love and affirmation.
Those aren't particularly 80s tropes, are they?
They were kind of all over what's his name, John Hughes and Pretty in Pink. The Breakfast Club, which I hate it, but that's another discussion for another time.
I really, really liked it. I wasn't blown away.
I quite liked the lead. I thought she was quite good. I don't know if she was terrible.
And I'd like to point out as well, my wife liked it as well. We were all sat watching.
You can play with archetypes. That's fine. If you, particularly in this wrestling context, if you demonstrate that the people put in those positions are real people, are characters compromised and sort of put into stereotypical mould.
Going back to your point about liking things that are in 30-minute chunks, I quite like the fact that it was in 30-minute chunks, but yeah. I felt there was a lot of faffing around in the first two episodes. They probably could have compressed those first two episodes into 10 minutes, and then you're off and
put
running.
Some more jokes.
I've got to say,
first
ad
break, well, there aren't ad breaks on Netflix, but...
I also really liked... The main kind of the male character, the only kind of really male character in the thing, Mark Maron, the actor, is actually a podcast host. Andrew,
oh right, yeah. is that Mark Maron? That's
Mark Maron. Yeah.
So we could get into Netflix. We could be on TV.
but he's got kind of interesting career trajectory in that he was a stand-up, he was a radio presenter. His radio show got canned. He started doing a podcast called WTF. Which has become so successful that he's interviewed. It's famously recorded in his garage, and Barack Obama's come on the show, and it's almost like a career redemption thing for him as well, which is quite an interesting kind of subtext. But I think he does it. I think he plays that kind of sleaze.
I kind of quite liked his fly blown cynicism. I'm basically just doing this. I think what was set up in the first episode was he's got a massive drug habit and he's just a failed director.
Movie producer,
and he just needs to kind of get something away to pay off the bills. And I like the fact that I'm just doing this for the cash.
I'm going to stick around and find out what happens, Sally. I'll send you an email. I'm
prepared to give it another two episodes. I agreed to this last night, although my boyfriend sort of hated it as well. So okay. We'll see how we go.
Well, tell him that a robot turns up at one point. And I'm not lying, a robot does turn up at one point. Okay, well, Glow's on Netflix now, and it's only half an hour an episode if you want to investigate for your own point of view. Time for a quick commercial break. As you might know, we've got a sister podcast, and it's doing really well. It's not about music or TV, it's about politics, and the clue is in the name. It's called Remaniacs, and every week it looks at the unfolding disaster that is Brexit and unpicks the news stories. As you might guess, we're pretty sceptical about the whole Leave the EU idea. So if you're a fellow proud Ramona or a Leave voter who doesn't mind having their ideas tested, or just in neutral, in which case how? Have a listen and see what you think. Our presenters are Big Mouth regular Dorian Linsky of The Guardian, plus Ian Dunt of politics.co.uk and ex-economist business editor Peter Collins. Remaniacs is on Audioboom, iTunes, Spotify and Pocket Casts. You can find links to all those outlets at our spiffing new website, remaniacs.com. That's remain with an IACS on the end. Okay, let's get back into the music. Eamon Ford, what have you brought in for us, please?
What have I brought in? I brought in a song called Tasteless by a band called Shame, who are the most exciting band I've seen in 25 years. I absolutely love them.
I have been to see U2.
Unfortunately, I saw them completely by accident at a conference/festival in Oslo, and somebody I know... recommend go and see this band. They're called Shame. They're on at 11:30 in this venue. Didn't tell me anything about them. Within the first song, I was going, oh, I quite like this band. And then within three songs, I was going, this is absolutely the best band I've seen in years. To the point where when they'd finished, I had to go home because I just couldn't go and see any other bands because I didn't think it was going to be fair. They're all like kind of 1920 from Camberwell. They're basically the Fat White Family, but with songs. And they're just the most thrilling live band in the world. It's just Meaty Bloke, the singer, would be shirts taps off, as Scottish people say, within three songs. And in the crowd, staring people down. And they're simultaneously exciting and terrifying. And they've got the songs. And I've seen them three times already this year. And I basically want to see them once a week for the rest of my life. I love them so much. They're so exciting.
Well, here we go. Male nudity warning. This is Shame with Tasteless. That was Heartless Shame with Tasteless, as chosen by the Tasteless, Eamon Ford. Sticking with music, public service broadcasting have carved out a niche over the past couple of years with a brilliantly simple idea. The hypnotic, repetitive pulse of krautrock guitars, plus evocative newsreel samples taken from since the beginning of broadcasting. Their records are a form of impressionistic documentary. The last one, The Race for Space, covered the adventures of the first astronauts, and now every valley looks at the life, culture and decline of the Welsh mining industry. It's out next week on the 7th of July, and we're going to talk about it after this track. This is Public Service Broadcasting with People Will Always Want Coal. People Will Always Want Coal from Every Valley by Public Service Broadcasting. And if Spinal Tap hadn't already stolen the word rockumentary, it would be perfect for their style. By an amazing coincidence, we have an actual Welsh person in the studio, Sally Hughes, a.k.a. Hughes the Lipstick. Sally, what did you make of this rather poignant record?
Poignant's the word. I actually grew up in a mining community and lived through the miners' strike, and my stepfather was on strike and various members of my family. So it actually meant quite a lot to me, this album. I found myself, I had quite a visceral reaction to it, I have to say. It took me right back. There are various voiceovers of the wives of miners, of strikers, of former miners talking seemingly now about the death of the industry. And I found it all very upsetting because that's my community. And they came out of the miners' strike, were absolutely screwed over. And then something called the EU came along and helped them out enormously. And now that is going away in part because of how they voted. So I find the whole thing very emotional. And upsetting. And I'm not sure how often I could listen to it in the future, but nonetheless, it had quite a profound effect on me. Do you know, it slightly made me feel like, you know, Man of Arran by British Sea Power?
Yes.
It slightly made me feel like that in this sort of, although it's a very different time and it's a very different part of the country and story and so on, it sort of had that the toil of the working man against all the odds sort of feel to it, and the ambience of that. It had a sort of similarly emotional effect on
me. It's very elegiac as well. It all seems to take place in black and white, and there's a romance to it.
There is a romance, and Tracy Ann Campbell from Camera Obscura sings one of the songs, and she's really great on it. And somehow, in my head, she's sort of married to James Dean Bradfield, who sings on sort of tracks. So, because the whole thing feels like a film. It feels like a black and white film.
I thought it was interesting the way that, you know, there's the first voice that you hear is kind of the non-more recognisable Richard Burton.
Yeah.
But I thought it was really interesting. James Dean Bradfield doesn't do his usual angry
leather lungs
bellowing kind of thing. Everything's subsumed into the whole of telling the story and kind of reflecting the communities that it came from. I thought it was brilliant. I went back and listened to the Space Race one that they did previously. Hmm. I thought it was really, because I was wondering at the start, are they going to be able to change the mood? Because the mood in...
It's called The Race for Space.
The Race for Space,
hence the name.
Was very kind of excited and propulsive and kind of really optimistic. Mm. Whereas somehow, and I think it may be kind of... A musician might be able to say it's kind of minor chords or there's some... This is very elegiac. It's very...
Minor in minor chords.
Absolutely, yes. Well, it struck me as it's like... I was thinking, this is like basically the krautrock under Milk Wood, you know? It's kind of like rock and roll version of that sort of... half remembered and for a lot of us kind of semi-real and distant world where you know, there was community that perhaps we're not familiar with now. I mean, I think it's easy to romanticize this, isn't it, because it was a horrible industry and it killed the people who worked in it. But when you hear the final words you hear from a miner are, I love being part of it, and I'm so sad that it's gone.
But that's what the Richard Burton thing at the start is saying as well, talking about being kind of lords of the underground and, you know, kings and the miners having a kind of real feeling that they were the ultimate kind of manual, you know, manual.
Yeah. And the ultimate men as well.
There was a really pride in there.
And there's talk of all the pubs being full on payday, which was absolutely the case where I lived. There were several working men's clubs along the high street of the village I lived in. And I think there's a voiceover later on of a woman talking about, there used to be so many shops here. And it's true, the little village I grew up in, we had a bank, we had a bakery, we had greengrocers, we had a couple of newsagents. There were loads of shops, and there is literally literally nothing there. Yeah. There's literally nothing there, and that is because of the death of mining.
Yeah. Eamon, what did you think of it?
Can I be the voice of mild cynicism or sort of reserved cynicism? When I read what it was about, I kind of pictured in my head already what this album was going to sound like, and it was exactly what I kind of imagined. So, I guess they've gone with the big concepts. They did the space albums, so they've done the decline of mining. I thought perhaps it was a little bit heavy-handed with the signifiers. It was just kind of banging you over the head.
Declaration. I used to work with one of the guys in public service broadcasting, John, who's the kind of, what's the name, Jay Wildebeest or Wildegoose or whatever.
Wildegoose, John Wildegoose.
Yeah.
Jay Wildegoose Jr.
He was a radio producer and then worked in BBC Archives, and he comes to it with a kind of archivist's kind of mindset, and he's constrained by what's out there. You know, I'm sure that if they're, you know, he's got, it's the archive that's
well,
available.
Well, on this album, they're not constrained because they've got singers, so they wrote lyrics for this album
for
the first time.
Yeah.
But in terms of the voices of the miners.
Of course, you know, no, that's kind of stuff that's out there. But I just felt, I don't know, maybe it just felt a little bit obvious.
Do you think there should be a reply track where they take the voices of Ian McGregor from and Margaret Thatcher saying the mines are shit, we're going to close it down.
No,
wasn't that done, wasn't there a cut-up, was it Cold Cut did The Enemy Within?
You're talking about the era then. It's funny for an album that comes out in 2017 that talks about the early to mid-80s. It actually sounds quite 90s to me. The music sounds quite 90s. Yeah. I kept expecting someone to go, this boy needs therapy. You know what I mean?
Well, actually, it does arrive at a funny time now that everybody's gone Corbyn mental. And there's a generation of sort of younger, radicalised, left voters who haven't had personal experience of either Thatcherism or the miners' strike or anything. And I can see them viewing this as a kind of great heroic kind of, you know, the way you know, people see films about the Second World War. They have no personal experience, but they see themselves somehow driven by it. And I can see people taking this as an inspiration. I mean, the miners' strike is obviously a massively complicated thing because yes, it threw a lot of people on the trash heap and left them with nothing to do. But did we really want to perpetuate an industry that killed the people who worked in it? You know, it's much more complicated. And you know, music is great at making the big, simple emotional statements, and I think this does it brilliantly. But I'm not sure you can necessarily take it as a political text.
But to me, the big political thing that's overlooked in this is the fact that, yes, as you say, it was a dying industry and an industry that wasn't helping the environment. What happened, though, was that entire swathes of the country were just dumped. They completely lost everything. They lost their communities. They lost their livelihoods. They were given no training. They were given no career development. Nothing happened until the EU social fund came in. And that, for me, is the political take home from this. Yeah. The fact that all of the things that were done latterly for those communities that were absolutely screwed over is about to be taken away.
I think it will be thematically different. Well, I'd say tonally difficult to have a closing track that goes, and look what the stupid bastards did. They voted to say no to the money that was saving.
It would be tonally very difficult. But that's why I suppose it upset me so much, because actually improvement was made and it's about to go again.
Well, talking about areas of the UK that benefited from the European Social Fund, Northern Ireland was one. So, but good that they've turned their back on extremism and the peripheral nut reporters haven't taken over. Yeah. No, it's not like any of us have learned anything from any of this.
There's no magic money tree, Eamon.
There is a magic money tree.
There's a billion pounds.
It's a magic money orange tree.
Yes.
That's what it is.
It's exactly that.
One last thing I just wanted to say about this record, because I think it's really interesting, is that it is sequenced chronologically. It begins with great optimism. Yeah. It begins with songs called, well, we heard it earlier, People Will Always Want Coal, with samples from those recruitment ads going, it's a great future.
Those
years
were brilliant. I mean, you kind of you even if I haven't heard Richard Burton talking about his childhood in Wales, you kind of feel that you have because you know his voice.
Yes.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
But when you get those coal boards kind of ads saying like there's 400 more years more coal, it's
we'll
still
be
in the
doing
ground
this for,
you know,
thousands of years. Yeah,
that is,
and
kind of a real,
you sort of reach the peak in the middle where the strikes occur, and the two closing tracks are utterly heartbreaking. The penultimate one is called Mother of the Village, and it's how the pit was the mother of the village, and without that made everything happen. Without the pit, there's nothing. And then it finishes with this male voice choir, you know, which is,
I mean, a male voice choir just kills me every time. They could sing literally anything and I would burst into tears, but particularly on this subject, it broke me.
You could sing Jeremy Corbyn to the tune of Seven Nation Army.
Let's not go that far. Okay, so I think this is a fantastic album and a classic, and I mean, I wonder what other things they could do. you know.
And do you know, they're brand new to me. I hadn't heard the Space album. I didn't really know anything about them. It was a total shock to me. And so the fact that they managed to draw me in the way they did was
quite
achievement.
They need to do a Brexit album.
Oh, God, no, I can't face the Brexit album. No, I mean, they've done in the past, they've done, on the first album they did, the Second World War, they did a little bit of the welfare state. They did a single about skiing that was entirely in Dutch, I think, which is pretty Dutch voice samples. Yeah. And then they did the Race for Space. I think they should do the full, Alwyn Turner history of Britain since the war. They should do an album for the 50s, an album for the 60s, an album for the 70s. And
did you do one about the NHS?
Yes.
They should do that, yeah. Put it on.
They've done the Night Mail as well,
haven't
they?
They've done the Night Mail. Here's the Night Mail across the border.
Yeah, I'm into the NHS idea. That'd be good.
I think they should do the NHS one, put it on hospital records. Yeah. Anyway, right, so we are basically coming to the end of the show right now, which means it's time for closing time chatter, where our guests give us their conversation starters for the week. And we're going to do it a bit different this time, because both of our guests are on different sides of the same story. Eamon Ford hates festivals, and Sally Hughes has just come back from Glastonbury, glowing with goodwill and having turned into a complete hippie. Let's start with Eamon.
Let's have a reason
debate. Let's have a reason debate. Why do you hate festivals, you monster?
Why do I hate festivals? We don't have enough time for me to speak. I think they are.
How many festivals have you been to?
I've been to Glastonbury twice. I've been to the Big Chill. I've been to a few in Europe. So I've put in my time at festivals. I came up with a phrase over the weekend about Glastonbury. It's hipster Guantanamo. I think it's basically people choosing and paying a huge amount of money to be uncomfortable. There's lots of people there. Invariably, there's lots of awful people there. People become hippies, which is never, ever a good thing. The music always sounds terrible. People forget that when you're there, you stand around for about 9 hours a day waiting for stuff to happen and nothing happens.
Enjoying yourself.
No.
Chatting to your friends and shit.
You're at the mercy of the weather.
I bet if it was a Coronation Street field, you'd go.
Do you know what? I think it's also the lack of sleep, because I don't operate well on a lack of sleep, and you do not sleep, and I'm just too old for this.
How much sleep did you get, Andrew?
And also, it's toilets.
I bet you get your full 8 hours, don't you?
A fair whack of sleep, yeah. Get up early and start, kind of thing. Yeah. You know, get the wet wipes out. Sally, tell him why he's wrong. Talk some sense into this clown.
I don't think that you can describe a demographic for Glastonbury. You can fairly for lots of festivals. I've been to many festivals, been to Glastonbury several times. And Glastonbury, I think, is the one that you cannot define with a simple demographic. You cannot say everyone's a hippie. You cannot say everyone's a hipster. It's just simply not true. It's so vast.
They're hippiesters.
It's so vast. There are 250,000 people there. It's so varied. There genuinely is something for everybody. And the
Except
other thing
me.
Is, nobody... the other thing is, there is nowhere else you can go, I don't think, in the world, for 4 days where nobody is mean, nobody raises their voice. Nobody is rude. Nobody, you know, the moment somebody steps on your toe, they go, all right, mate. Yeah. And everybody is just thoroughly nice to each other. And when, as I necessarily do for my job, you spend quite a lot of time on the internet and you just sort of lose hope in humanity and think everyone's an arsehole and constantly angry and shouty, to go to Glastonbury is really magical, I think. The music this year was exceptional. And the other brilliant thing about Glastonbury and the music specifically is that you fall in love with acts that you wouldn't normally go and see. I wouldn't normally go and see Stormzy, and yet it was one of the best things I saw all weekend. It was phenomenal. I saw so much good stuff. The Pretenders, when can you wake up and have your breakfast in front of Chrissie Hynde singing Him to Her? Yeah. You know, it's
were you having a bacon roll?
I was probably having a beer, to be honest. You know, listening to her sing Him to Her at like 10 o'clock in the morning, it's a wonderful thing. I just think it's magical. And I just didn't want to come home.
Well, I mean, I agree. I mean, I can understand. I know Eamon is festivals, not Eamon's cup of tea, but you know, there's a million different kinds of festivals.
Just don't like tents.
It's a 4 day beer garden with your friends.
There you go. We could set up a set with Glastonbury with no music.
Do you know what? If I could be parachuted in for like an hour and a half each day and then kind of brought home, I would do that. But
listen to Jim Iroquois. Well, my own little Glastonbury bit is two things. One is completely frivolous. When we went to see Radiohead, who was dancing in front of us, capering around like a pair of fools? Sienna Miller and Matt Smith, Doctor Who. Dead excited. And I was so starstruck that I barged over to Matt Smith and offered him a nip of my patent summer cocktail. And he declined with thanks, because I think he thought that I was a Daily Mail journalist trying to spike him with something naughty.
Fair
but
enough.
They were having a proper good time. But the serious aspect of it I wanted to mention on Glastonbury was there's a great piece on a website called inews.co.uk, headlined, "If you're asking what poor person could be at Glastonbury, then you've never been poor." And it's about the Glastonbury deniers who say, oh yeah, it's all middle class people. The ticket's £240, therefore everybody there must be rich, and therefore nobody can possibly talk about any sort of fairness in the world. How dare they politicise former CND festival, the Glastonbury Pop Festival? The fact is, hard up people have always been able to get into Glastonbury because it's your dream. It's like you've got no money and you haven't got a pot to piss in, but you've got something to look forward to. And the idea that just because people are, you know, on minimum wages or on benefits, that they should never, ever have anything nice. They should be eating Tesco value mince for the rest of their lives. I reject this. I say no to the
And half place. The people in hospitality are people who know crew members, security people, roadies and so on. They're not celebrities.
The Glastonbury Blag is a great British tradition, is it not?
Yeah. Get into being pushed over the fence were great days.
Or going to collect litter, or going to work on the bars, or just find a way of getting in. And the idea, which is propagated by, let's face it, fairly nasty newspapers and magazines who have an agenda, the idea that this is full of the sort of chattering middle-class media bubble is just horseshit.
In a wider way, as well, there is nothing bluesier than being in Glastonbury and glancing at social media and just seeing this kind of tirade of people moaning about how shit it must be to be in Glastonbury. It's really tedious. People, fine if you're slagging off the music you're watching on TV. You're a viewer, that's your right. But the kind of constant, oh, I'm glad I'm not there. I bet they're having a terrible time. It's just a real downer. Just disengage if you don't want to go.
Well, as friend of the podcast Dorian Linsky said, the best bit about being at Glastonbury is not having to read all the people moaning about. Yeah. Awful Glastonbury is who aren't there.
I was thinking, no, you've converted me. I'll go next year.
Okay. I hope it's on next year.
Do
you know the best thing? One of the things that we did at the Guardian that was the BBC have this webcam that they set up at the farmhouse and they point it at the main stage, the pyramid stage, and they have it takes a shot every 10 minutes and it shows the field filling up, and it's one of the biggest things on the BBC website. Mm-hmm. When I was at the Guardian, on the last fallow year. Because the Guardian sponsors Glastonbury, they rang up, the Evises rang up and said, do you want to do the webcam this weekend, which would have been the Glastonbury weekend. And we went, yeah, great. We went down and we set it up and it just pointed at a field, and occasionally you saw some cows wandering backwards and forwards. But it was like one of the most viewed things on the Guardian website that weekend.
People weeping that they were
basically Andy Warhol's empire.
We ran it for the full 72 hours.
This time next year we'll be sat there at a computer crying. So there we go. That's another show in the bag. Thanks to our guests. Sally Hughes, what are you up to next, Hughes? She's drinking her coffee. What are you up to next?
I've got to finish writing a really big piece for the rest of the day. And then I'm going home tomorrow. I'm making a documentary for the BBC.
Ooh, what's the documentary about?
It is called The Truth About Looking Good. And it is debunking the sort of marketing myths around beauty.
Fantastic. Okay, well, thanks for coming in. You're welcome back on Big Mouth anytime you like. Em Ford, thank you for coming in. What have you got up next?
I am buried extra deep in a book that I'm writing at the minute, or researching at the minute, which is on the wonderful time of EMI and Terra Firma. So I'm in the throes of doing all the research and interviews for that. So
you're not doing your I Heart Bono book for a bit?
No, I am. I am as well, yes. Okay. It's 4,000 pages explaining my great love for Bono and his great music.
Fantastic. Okay, well, listeners, remember, you can hear this episode of Big Mouth again and all of our past shows at audioboom.com/Big Mouth. You can subscribe in the podcast section of the iTunes music store if you wish. Just search and find us. It's dead easy. And excitingly, we're now on Spotify as well. So we'll put links for Spotify on the Facebook page and Twitter. And every time you listen, we'll get 0.00001p. Or something like that. Special.
Split four ways.
It's a sustainable future.
Absolutely.
It's all about scale.
It's all about scale. So, you know, streaming all round. Yes, links to all that will be on the Facebook page and the Twitter page. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening and farewell.